Admiral Nelson, I believe it's Nelson, I'm losing track of my notes, of the Coast Guard is here along with Frank A. Rossi, Dennis Kelso, the Commissioner of the State Department of Environmental Conservation. Yes, it's Admiral Ed Nelson, the Commandant of the 17th Coast Guard District. They've all gathered here. The press corps is here. We're expecting a major press conference, a major status report, a conference that is organized and headed by the ADEC, the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. While this gets underway, from the Valdez Civic Center, which is situated on a hilltop overlooking Port Valdez with a clear view of the Alaska Marine Terminal. We have a good view of the terminal, and about half an hour ago, the tanker Arco Sag River did arrive. This morning at the Coast Guard press conference, we did hear confirmation that the captain of the port, Commander Steve McCall of the U.S. Coast Guard, had approved on an experimental basis, so one tanker to be brought into the port to see if it was possible to bring it in without going through any slick areas. The tanker Arco Sag River did enter Port Valdez and is now tied up at Berth 1 at the Alaska Marine Terminal. One of the questions that has been raised consistently over the last 4 days has been the fact that Alaska has needed to slow down the throughput of the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline because their storage capacity at the Valdez Terminal was filling up. Basically at the full almost 2 million barrel a day throughput level that Alaska has been using for almost 2 years now since the great oil price crash. It takes only about four and a half days to totally fill up the tank farm at Alaska. That's assuming the tanks were totally empty when this problem began. There's been concern that unless tankers were allowed to come in, the pipeline itself would have to be shut down. This does cause a lot of impact and can create difficulties in starting up tanker flow once again. At this point, the Arco Sag River is across the bay at Berth 1 with at these reduced throughput of 800,000 barrels a day, which Alaska had announced they'd reduced to. The arrival of even one tanker gives Alaska at least 24 hours, perhaps as long as 48 hours before they have to worry again about running out of storage capacity. Essentially, the Arco Sag River will be used as a floating storage tank until the port truly is open and normal tanker traffic does resume. There are 9 other tankers waiting to be allowed into the port beyond the Bligh Island Reef area where the stricken Exxon Valdez is aground. Another 20 miles or so is a point called Knoll's Head in Prince William Sound. This is the approved waiting area. Oftentimes when the port is closed due to bad weather conditions, that's where tankers will wait. Or if there are more tankers in Port Valdez than can be accommodated, that's where they'll wait before they're allowed permission to enter the port. Right now there are 9 tankers waiting there since the Arco Sag River has been allowed to enter the port itself. Coast Guard this morning did confirm that one tanker would be allowed. At this point, the port is not fully open to commercial traffic, but one tanker has been authorized to enter the port. That tanker is now here in Port Valdez. This morning, we also heard that there will be a major controlled burn today. The bad news has been that Prince William Sound's western side, which is truly wilderness area, most of which is U.S. National Forest land, massive fjords, many glaciers, towering mountains rising precipitously from the water. The islands on the western side of Prince William Sound that shelter the mouths to these fords and inlets have been surrounded by oil. Instead of acting as a barrier, the islands basically have apparently slowed down or split the oil stream from the slick. Instead of traveling in one long lane, sort of a long rectangle as was described yesterday, the oil is now filtering in, around, and through between the passages between the islands, Knight Island, Smith Island, Naked Island, Eleanor Island, Seal Island, these islands over on the western part of the sound. This does, of course, mean that there will be oil not just on the northeast sides of these islands, as had been discussed yesterday, but there'll be oil all around the beaches on the island. About an hour ago, Don Cornett of Exxon Anchorage announced that the cleanup effort had gotten underway. He described basically the process of raking the oil off of beaches of sand. However, there are very few sand beaches in Prince William Sound. Again, more often than not, mountains rise precipitously from the sea in this very spectacular scenic area. When there is oil on the rocks, the process is to wash the oil off the rocks with high-pressure hoses and then skim it off the surface, then going in literally with rags, brushes, even toothbrushes if necessary, to wash down the rocks, literally washing the shore of Prince William Sound Islands by hand. This is a process that will definitely take months and involve hundreds of laborers. A couple of subcontractors to Exxon, led principally by Vico and Norcom, a subsidiary of Vico, are at this point accumulating personnel, and now State Commissioner of the Department of Environmental Conservation, Dennis Kelso, is about to begin this conference. This is a live broadcast from the Valdez Civic Center in Valdez, Alaska.
My name is Dennis Kelso. I'm the Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. This is our first press conference since the spill event began, and I'd like to share with you today three major areas that we'd like to provide information, as is our standard operating procedure. We will be available for any questions. I want you to feel free to contact us at any time, even outside this press conference, and our interest is in making sure you have the information that we have and that we can proceed together with the same understanding of where we're going. I was warned that there wouldn't be room for any kind of notes up here, and I see that's true. So I'm happy that I didn't bring too many notes, and I'll try to be brief. Let me introduce some other people here that I'd like to involve in this at some point. But before I do, I'd like to convey Governor Cooper's greetings. He has been following this very closely. We have been briefing him twice a day, and he will be coming again to Valdez this afternoon. So he wanted me to be sure and pass on his greetings, and he was sorry that he couldn't be here for this event. In a few moments, I'm going to introduce Larry Dietrich, who's sitting over in the corner here. Larry is the director of my Division of Environmental Quality. He's in charge of all the pollution control programs that the state of Alaska maintains. I'm going to ask Larry to summarize the current status and the current state action plan. And I think you'll find that there's a substantial amount of new information there. Larry, if you'd be ready to come on up in a couple of moments, we'll be ready to go. On the stage here with me are some people that are probably familiar to many of you. Admiral Nelson from the U.S. Coast Guard, Frank Irasi from Exxon, Mayor John Devens, Mayor of the City of Valdez, and Jack Lamb, who's President of the Cordova District Fishermen United. Each of those people has had an important role in what has happened to date, and I think you will see that we are embarking on a new course that involves the involvement of each of these people. The three things I'd like to cover this afternoon are along these lines. First, the state's involvement and our current action plan for dealing with the spill. Second, what I'm calling the Fisherman's Strike Force. And third, a new management structure that is being implemented to carry out spill response activities throughout the duration of this spill event. I'm going to start with the state's action plan because I think the update may be useful to you. So Larry, you want to come on up here, and as Larry is coming up, let me just describe to you in general what we have done. We have brought to Valdez between 30% and 40% of Larry's entire statewide staff. Those people are organized into two large technical teams, one generally focused on impact monitoring, and the second dealing with containment and cleanup, and that includes spill mapping. I've been here since the first flight I could catch on Friday morning, and we have been maintaining 24-hour coverage not only in our response office, but also on the vessels. We've had staff on the Exxon Valdez since 3 a.m. the morning of the spill, and we have also maintained continuous coverage on the Exxon Baton Rouge since the Baton Rouge was brought into position for offloading operations. We developed a field action plan, which we have been systematically pursuing. That involves periodic mapping of the spill. We have real-time mapping that provides the most comprehensive picture available of the progress of the spill, and I think Larry will talk about that, so I'm not going to get into it further. We are prepared now to begin a major new phase. Frankly, we are past the opportunity to recover much oil. Now we are looking at defensive measures to protect particularly sensitive environments and cleanup. We are putting our primary emphasis today into defensive measures, and we've identified specific priority areas which we will describe to you and describe the reasons for, and I think Jack Lamb will also go into some of the reasons for selecting those priorities. I don't want to give you a misimpression. This is a very tough situation. The defensive measures are not easily implemented, and we have a spill that's on the move and widely distributed now in some highly sensitive areas. However, we believe that it's essential to use defensive measures wherever we can. And by defensive measures, I'm talking now about efforts to exclude oil from moving into those areas, to deflect it so that it remains offshore, and to pick it up when it gets into those inshore areas that are particularly important for biological reasons or to the fishermen, which I'll defer to Larry and Jack to describe. We are not neglecting cleanup, but we are making sure that if we have the opportunity for defensive intervention, that we do that first. If we can keep this oil out of those critical areas, then we will have accomplished something. But I want you to know that we are not going to be able to keep oil out of all the important areas by any means. The sound is very productive, it's highly sensitive, and we are certainly looking at a situation where most of those areas we're just not going to be able to touch. But the ones that we can, we're mobilized, and we're going to hit them as hard as we're able. We have five vessels now underway to implement the state's portion of this, and without taking more time now giving you a general overview, I'd like to introduce Larry Dietrich, who will give you the specifics. I want to be careful that we don't run too close to the press deadlines that are involved here, and I know there's a 1 o'clock witching hour. So rather than exhaust the time with too many questions for Larry, I'd like to just make the commitment to you that if you still have questions that we haven't had a chance to get to, what we'll do is let Larry give the overview, and if you would please not interrupt him during the overview, we'll take a few questions, and then we'll hold the rest of the questions, cover the brief presentations that we have with the other members of this panel, and then we will stay as long as you need to cover the rest of the material. Is that still consistent? Now, I want to make sure, I'll say one thing. It's my intention to spend as much time as we need to answer your questions, but I also want to get this guy back out in the field. So we'll strike a balance there if you're willing. All right, go ahead.
The name is Larry Dietrich. It's D-I-E-T-R-I-C-K. Okay, I think I'll start out and give you a
Is it better?
Can you get close enough so I can point? Do I need to talk in here while I point?
Tell me what the angle needs to be, you know.
Good enough. I need to be able to point. Is that going to interfere with that? Okay, I'll give you an update on the plume now. There's probably... most of you know. To start out, we had a big pancake here in the middle. We had some high winds the other night, and basically what's happened is the plume has kind of wrapped around Naked Island. Okay, we're getting some product.
Can you stop a second so we can get some mics up there? We can't hear you this way.
Sure.
We're having some difficulties accommodating both the cameras and the audio feeds and working with the map, so there's a little bit of confusion going on. We just heard a presentation from Dennis Kelso, who is the Commissioner of the Department of Environmental Conservation. He did indicate that Governor Cooper will be arriving with Jerry Pesky, his Chief of Staff, this afternoon, along with the Director of Transportation, Secretary from the U.S. Government, the Commandant of the Coast Guard, and the head of EPA.
Division of Environmental Quality.
There are three things covered today on this meeting. One is and the major thing perhaps is there is a new management structure. This indicates the state may have taken a more aggressive role in taking control of the spill response away from Exxon, who has had the lead role to this point. So we're anticipating hearing what exactly will be the change or shift in the management structure later on in this conference. Again, right now there is a considerable amount of scurrying about going on to reset microphones and camera angles so that Larry Dietrich, who's the head of environmental quality for the state of Alaska Department of Conservation. This is Larry Dietrich.
First 3 days out there in the middle, we had some high winds. As best as I can, I'll try to trace out what it's got right now. It's basically moved over. This area is now fundamentally clear. And what we're doing is we're getting our first land impacts. Naked Island was the first area impacted, and we got something that looks like this. It goes down to Smith Island. We're getting tongues now that are coming out here with some fingers and chains this way. Shoreline impact in these areas, generally speaking, is generally moving this way on this side. The bad thing is, this is a very dynamic plume. This is the most complex difficult containment situation I've ever experienced, and certainly may set some kind of record, I don't know, but this thing is moving and changing. It's very difficult to predict it. There was a bubble that come up through the passage between Naked Island and Point Eleanor. It's wrapped around in here. This area is pretty well heavily impacted, and we're getting some things down this way.
What's the name of the island?
You name the island.
Okay, this is Night Island. The big island here is Night Island. This is Naked Island. This is Smith Island. Okay? So that's generally what we have as of our last overflight, and that's what we're dealing with. Each time period, particularly the nighttime periods, are the most difficult time because we've got the longest period of time in which we don't know what's happening. It's very difficult to predict what we're going to see first thing in the morning. Trying to get ahead of this a little bit and manage it. As the commissioner said, we're in a defensive posture now. We're in a position of identifying the priority biological resources here where we can marshal all available resources to set up a line of defense. We were very fortunate last night in having finally joined up with the fishermen for Cordova. We've done some intensive exchange of information, determine what those biological areas are so that we can concentrate on those priorities. The priorities, as they turned out, are going to be the hatcheries. There are four hatcheries. This is a seed stock for Prince William Sound and are the primary targets for today's activities. The number one priority hatcheries are in Main Bay, located here. The other number one priority is Port San Juan down here. Next in the line of business is the Ishmeet Bay right here, and last is up here at Esther. So these are the ones that we feel need absolute protection. You can see where these are in relationship to what we're dealing with in a plume right now. We were fortunate. We have, I believe, 8 or 10 Cordova fishing boats on scene deploying boom in both of these areas as of about 11 o'clock. We have boom deployment expertise on the boats. We are developing boom deployment management teams. Basically, we're protecting these mouths, and we'll be trying to position these, depending on the behavior of the plume as it moves over, to deflect and try to route product down this way. The goal being to keep it out of Main Bay and Ishmeet Bay. So I feel very good that this is now underway today. We've got people in the field. We've got expertise. We're developing communication. We're going to try to bolster that with aerial observation so that these guys can manage these booms. The other effort down here, Port St. Juan, if I hear what the fishermen are telling me, they want to make this a fortress, and we are doing that. We have our sky crane is moving in all remaining available containment boom in here today. Exxon will be bringing in additional boom by plane today. The Sky Crane will be picking that boom up, whether he comes in Valdez or Cordova, and we hope to have the additional containment boom in position down here with a deployment team and a boom management team and substantial amounts of sorbent boom. And they will design a defense system to try to basically direct the flow around this way.
What island is the San Juan hatchery on, please?
Evans.
Is that one of the world's biggest hatcheries?
I think Main Bay is. These are two. Yeah, I don't know.
The Koenig hatchery, is that what you're referring to? The Koenig hatchery?
Yeah, this is. They're getting ready here for a fry release. So this is a key area. So everything is being marshaled today. The Coast Guard is supporting with communications. Exxon is helping with logistical support. And we want to get these defense mechanisms in place and actively manage these while we watch what this thing does. Our other things, in terms of biological priorities, shore cleanup is secondary at this point. Impacted areas will wait for a mop-up team. The other control measures that are available that are being looked at jointly by Exxon, the Coast Guard, and us are burning and dispersion. This area here probably has the highest biological resource potential in the area here. There's been a lot of concern about things bleeding off and coming down between Green Island and Montague Island. So far, that area is okay, but that would mean that since the drift is this way, this is where the natural flow comes in and goes out. Dispersion would be an option if you get a pancake up here to break that up and keep it out of this area. The idea here is to avoid this area.
What is that area called?
This is the Green. We're calling it the Green Island Montague area. The other area, of course, then is to monitor if this behaves over towards Astor Bay. We do not have boom deployment there yet. We are watching this front and gearing up to do this. We've contracted with five other vessels that are en route and should be on scene, that we're going to basically put them in a hold pattern here today. And what they will do is augment boom management for these two as necessary. And as more containment boom comes in, we'll have them go up and deploy this. There are additional fishing boats coming in support of this. And the fishing boats and Black Hawk and Sky Crane will be doing the boom deployment and control down in this area. Once we get this in place and we feel that these are secure and stable, we will proceed then on to other sensitive areas around here. There's an entire biological resource team in place. I think they're fully coordinated now with all the three principals, and the biological resource information is being funneled into the cleanup teams, and they will be prioritizing other areas then that have not been impacted. And that will be the next thing we want to do, is to start deflecting things to prevent further areas from getting up. And then finally, there will be a mop-up team. There are some dispersion efforts and burning things that Exxon will have a meeting on this afternoon to see if we can start to manage this plume, if you will. So those are the priorities at this point. That's what's happening. The other thing that we're doing with this is we feel that there is a need for intensive overflight monitoring because of the way this thing is behaving. So we are scheduling. We had a coordinated flight this morning, at least four flights a day, come back immediately mapped so that we can make adjustments with what people in the field are doing. The Valdez fishermen have joined up with us today. Last I talked to them, they're talking about organizing and providing a possible what they call mosquito fleet to start working on developing technologies to deal with already impacted areas. Our original five vessels were intended to start looking at what could be done in the impacted Naked Island area. We've temporarily pulled them off to augment this, because this is more important at this point. As this comes under control, we will have them join up with the mosquito fleet to start developing what can and can't be done to clean up some really difficult cleanup situations. And I think everybody recognizes dealing with these numbers of inlets and stuff, it will be complex and arduous at best. There are some other techniques that are available that are being looked at, and that's where you have heavy sheens coming down, take lower biological areas, biologically sensitive areas, and deflect the product into lagoons where skimmer operations can be mobilized and put into place. Exxon is planning some of these activities and are bringing in some of the skimmers to help that out. I do believe there is an incredible amount of resources that are being marshaled and will be coming into town, and we'll be getting in the field to deal with this. We simply need to make sure that we get a handle on it until all of those things are in place. So the ability to deal with this is going to improve here with time as these things get deployed. The fishermen are on board with this. I can't tell you, express my appreciation for when they walked in the door yesterday afternoon and were able to help us get this together and mark these areas and get a plan in place to happen today. And these things are all happening. So I feel comfortable about that. It's certainly not over, but I think we're starting the game now. So,
could you try to describe for us the significance of those four hatcheries, what percentage of total hatcheries in the state, or give us some feel for how important they are?
I think Jack Lamb's coming up here. I wouldn't even pretend to be a fisheries biologist. I long lined this area for 5 years, but I think hatcheries, Jack can speak to that, I believe.
Thank you. Can I ask again what you were asking?
I was trying to get some context for the significance of those four hatcheries. Have you got just what percentage of total hatcheries in the state, or some number that will give a reader a chance to understand why you're focusing on those four?
These four hatcheries here, okay, let me clarify just a little bit. There are actually only three hatcheries, okay, and that's not to refute, says Commissioner Dietrich. It's just simply East Shammy Bay is not a hatchery site. It is an extremely sensitive fishery to a unique set of fisheries, a unique fisheries effort. It's called set net siting, which I think most of you are probably familiar with Bristol Bay and Cook Inlet. It's a set net district, and those fishermen, in conjunction with the rest, have worked very hard over the last 10 years to build up a run there that they can go back and fish. They didn't get to fish it for several years, and because of that, and because of the flow that this is projecting, we felt that that was an area that needed as much consideration as anything else for that specific fishery and the effort that they had put out, okay? The other three are hatcheries. The one at Fort San Juan is the Armin F. Koning Hatchery. The one at Main Bay is referred to as Main Bay Hatchery, and of course, Esther Bay Hatchery. The significance of these hatcheries is that if you take a look at the history of Prince William Sound and its fisheries, the fisheries have continued to grow in Prince William Sound. The available stocks to the fishermen, and it's been because of the effort of fishermen and the hatcheries. The fishermen themselves are the ones that began the hatchery systems here. I would have a hard time trying to describe to you the numbers, but in terms of released fish, because they're astronomical, but the percentage of them that comes back averages, to my best understanding, 6 to 8% of the fry that are released come back. And this next year, we're looking at a total estimated return to the hatchery systems in Prince William Sound at approximately 30 to 35 million fish harvestable fish.
Pink
salmon primarily. And this is harvestable fish. That's not including the fish that would be kept by the hatcheries for meeting their financial obligations that they will sell on their own, plus the fish that are kept for brood stock in those hatcheries. So you have some idea that
how many hatcheries total will return this beneficial?
The total number of hatcheries will return those will be five.
So this is the three of the five?
Three of the five.
When does the run start, basically?
Pink salmon run basically will start approximately June 20th to 25th, and that's the light beginning. The main portion of the runs take place between the middle of July and the middle of August.
When do you release?
The release of those fry is beginning to take place right now.
What do they do when they release? Are they going to
end up in the oil after the release, even if they're not contaminated with it at the time of the release?
That's a lot of speculation, but the reason we've decided that we've named this these areas as specific areas of defense protection is so that in the absolute, if there's a worst case scenario and everything else got wiped out, we've got seed stock. The thing is that when these fry go out, they've got to go out into what is called an estuary. And that's where the water, the fresh and salt waters begin to mix together, where the plankton that they live on is immediately available for the first stages of growth. They're there for anywhere up to 4 weeks, to the best of my understanding. Then they begin to go out into the rest of the ecosystem. If they're in the area there that are saturated with hydrocarbons and things like this, it has the potential to be to kill off the runs, and it's that simple. I mean, that's why this effort is being made. That's why the state and the Exxon people, the control people, are working with us so heavily to protect this
industry. You're moving off the estuary also, so that area that you just described will not have oil in it?
Correct.
It sounds to me like you're not waiting for Exxon to take in charge of this anymore, that you guys have seized command of this yourself and to protect your own interests. Is that correct?
Let me make it simple. Right now, this minute is the beginning of the rest of our lives. I'm not going to project what happened in the past. It doesn't help the present, and it certainly isn't going to help the future. From this point forward, we are all working together to save our industry.
I beg your pardon, I couldn't hear you.
If you're working together, why is that still happening in the first place? You were warned about it years ago, and you're just now starting to put plans together to do anything about it. You had years to plan for this.
I'm trying to answer, that's not in the area of my expertise. I'm a fisherman. I represent the fishermen.
Mr. Dietrich, quick question. Can we get moving through the folks here?
Yeah, let's go.
The press conference is in somewhat of a disarray. There are a number of statements being shouted from the floor. This is a joint press meeting sponsored by under the aegis of the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. We've just been hearing from Jack Lamb, who is the president of Cordova District Fishermen United.
And then I'll yield the floor here and, of course, respond to questions. I'd like to ask Jack Lamb to come up here again and spend just a couple of minutes describing what I've referred to as the Fisherman's Strike Force and their initiative, which we are supporting.
That was Dennis Kelso, Commissioner of ADEC.
What I'd like,
this is Jack Lamb.
I simply indicated that I'm a fisherman and I can't answer the question that that gentleman asked.
Well, let me say that one of the reasons that we don't have a press conference very often is we want to come up here and share as much information as we can with you and cover new ground. I know that you've had a chance to talk with Exxon representatives about that, and I'm certainly prepared to share time, but the truth is I'd like to have this time cover the stuff that we're doing now and the direction we're heading. I think Mr. Iorossi is going to come up here in a bit and talk about the vessel situation and the offloading operation. And I'll be happy to answer any of your questions, but I'd request that if there are specifics that you're going to pursue with Exxon, I know Exxon has at least one press conference a day, and I'd request that you save them for that.
The projected run for this year?
Economic.
Please understand that what I'm saying is for a projected run for this year, based on Fish and Game's estimates that we receive, and the estimate for this year for salmon is in excess of $75 million ex vessel value. Okay, I was afraid of that. When I say ex vessel value, that is the value to the fisherman at the time he sells the fish in the round
To a processor. Okay, what I just would like to say is that from the time this thing has begun, the fishermen have been in a position of wanting to help in every way we can. Yesterday afternoon, for other reasons, I wound up in DEC's offices. Things had taken place that I was not aware of because I was busy with other things. What it boiled down to was that Commissioner Kelso and his representatives asked me to come into a room and began to show me and two other people that were with me what had taken place with that spill from the previous night until they were able to observe it yesterday afternoon for the first time in somewhere around a 14-hour period of non-observation, minimum 14 hours. It was appalling. They began to ask what we felt could be done. That was the beginning of the interface between the different agencies, Exxon and the fishermen. By the time we got through talking about the effects of this flow, and what we perceived as being the absolute most critical areas of protection for our fisheries, we were at a place where they wanted to know, what can you do to help us additionally? That was at approximately 8 o'clock last evening. We made a call to Cordova, where we've had vessels standing by. At 9 o'clock, we received a fax back with a list of 15 vessels that would be ready to go, and at 10 o'clock last night, the first one was underway. A fair share of them are on site now. I don't know the exact total, but all 15 of them are underway, and we expect to see all 15 of them available for deployment in any manner by 4 o'clock this afternoon. The fishermen themselves appreciate being called into this. We're involved in the, what I think is being referred to as the operations committee. We're working together on it. This is the stance we want. This is the stance we want to continue to maintain, and we'll make every effort to maintain. That's where we're at this point, and we feel that we're going to keep on going with it. Yes, to a certain degree, we felt like we had to take things into our own hands, but when we did that, everybody else realized that it was the same situation. Everybody had to get together and not do it on an individual basis. The boats were ready. We simply put them into motion. Thank you.
Jack Lamb, the president of CDFU Cordova District Fishermen United. Now, State Commissioner Dennis Kelso of ADEC.
An environmental conservation role that I'd like to mention, and that is when we're not doing the pollution control type of work that Larry Dietrich's division is responsible for, we have a variety of other responsibilities, one of which is seafood wholesomeness and safety. In other words, we inspect seafood of all kinds statewide. And some kinds of seafood cannot be shipped in interstate commerce unless it has been inspected by DEC, but all seafood is subject to DEC inspection in every plant throughout the state. I want to ensure that fishermen know that DEC will do whatever is necessary to ensure that seafood coming out of Prince William Sound has been properly inspected, that it is safe, that it is not contaminated. We will ensure that the product moving out of Prince William Sound can give consumers confidence and can continue to play the essential role that it plays in Alaska's fisheries industry. 2 years ago, we had a serious oil spill from another tanker vessel in Cook Inlet. It happened at the height of a very important salmon fishery. The sockeye run was just coming in. It was almost the 4th of July. There was a major recreational fishery happening. It was obviously at a very bad time. We inspected thousands and thousands of fish. We have a biological laboratory in Palmer, Alaska, where those samples are examined. And we were able to guarantee that the product entering the market was free of contamination and was of acceptable quality. So I just want to make the record clear that while we are still working with the pollution control aspect of this, we have already geared up for the seafood quality aspect, which of course has not yet begun. The third area that I mentioned that I wanted to highlight today is the new management structure. By the way, Jack mentioned that we are working closely together. It's both in terms of the substance and also physically. Cordova District Fishermen United will be operating from an office in the DEC Spill Response Headquarters. So if you need to contact them, feel free to come over to our shop and they'll be reachable there.
If I might, just for a moment, we've managed to even bring ourselves in an assistant executive director, Ms. Jeannie Buller. She's back here with us, and she'll also be willing to help field anything that you want to get to us. When you talk to, when you want to get to us, you'll probably be going through her, so recognize who she is. Her name is Jeannie Buller. She's excellent at what she does.
The third item that I mentioned was the new management structure. I will be brief, and then we'll also ask Admiral Nelson and Mr. Irasi and Mayor Devins to be able to say a couple of words. The new management structure is along these lines. The state proposed an integrated management structure that would ensure that decision-making involved fully the State of Alaska, Exxon, and the on-scene coordinator, which is the U.S. Coast Guard. We think that's essential because a coordinated response is the only way that we're going to have the presence to do what needs to be done in a preventive way in these defensive measures that Larry Dietrich described, and also to follow up with cleanup. We wanted to make sure that the structure allowed adequate support for Exxon's efforts, for the state's efforts, and for the fishermen. Exxon continues to have the responsibility to make sure that this spill is dealt with adequately. The Coast Guard continues to be the on-scene coordinator. But we have a positive, vigorous, new, shared decision-making structure, and I'll just describe the two elements of it right now. One element is the steering group. That's a policy-level group. It has decision-making authority, and it will involve Admiral Nelson, Mr. Irasi, and me. We'll be directing the overall response. The group will proceed through consensus decision-making, and while respecting the requirements for the on-scene coordinator's role, we will be proceeding with concurrence of all three participants in the steering group. The second element of this structure is operations and coordination. And there, the operations and coordination group will involve DEC, U.S. Coast Guard, fishermen, Exxon, and the City of Valdez has also offered to participate. That group will deal with specific decisions on a daily basis. Obviously, not every detail goes to them, or we'd end up not being able to get any work done. But the major course corrections on a daily basis are going to be handled by the operations and coordination group. They were in session until 3:30 this morning. They resumed at 9 o'clock, and I think Larry Dietrich has described some of the results. We have action underway. I want to be clear that what we're talking about here is a structure for action. We are not interested in having a structure for discussion purposes. The structure only has merit as it produces results in the field. And I'm convinced that all of the people you see here are committed to that, and we are, frankly, rolling up our sleeves and hitting the field. Let me pause now and ask Admiral Nelson if he'd like to add some comments.
Admiral Ed Nelson, Commandant of the 17th Coast Guard District.
The focus again on what we're doing and what's left of this problem is not over, as you're well aware. Jointly, the steering group and the operation coordinating committee focusing on two issues. One is the protection of those hatcheries and the prime area that Mr. Dietrich and Mr. Lamb addressed. Number two is the cleanup, and that's going to be a long-term process. And they are the ones we're addressing jointly, if you will. It's still a very big problem. It's principally Mr. Rossi's problem, and the salvage of the tank of Valdez. He will, I'm sure, tell you a little bit about that. I'm not going to walk over his lines. He will let you know how he feels about the progress. And the other issue, of course, is the reopening of the port. That has been done, and there are tankers that will be moving in under they'll be escorted first. And that there's a safety zone around the tanker, 1,000 yards. The other tankers will be able to go. The port is open. Fishermen will be able to move in and out. So those are the four parts of the problem, but that's the Coast Guard's problem, the ladder, the on-scene coordination. The other thing I would add right now, because I'm sure the other subjects I would be interested in are going to be covered, is that we will be having a visit this afternoon by the Secretary of Transportation. If you watch television this morning, you get an advantage over me. I didn't have a chance, but Secretary of Transportation Sam Skinner, the Administrative Environmental Protection Agency, Mr. Riley, Commandant of the Coast Guard, Admiral Paul Yost, and I know there are a couple more people. The governor will be here about an hour before. Those people principally, Mr. John Gaughan also was a formerly MARAD administrator, now in the department. Sir? I'm sorry?
What will they be doing this afternoon?
What they want to do initially, and I was asked this question earlier by a friend, I've already had the word that when they land, they want to go over, fly over the scene. We've got aircraft available. I'm trying to shorten the time so you'll have a chance to talk to them if possible. So I've asked if the pilots can make a run over the scene, at least the lower end of it, and just have them get a glance of it from the air. I don't know if that's going to satisfy them. They may still want to go out, certainly may want to go out over the tanker. We've got helicopters available to do that. When they get back, they want to sit down and talk with the commissioner, Mr. Iarossi, and me. And they do not want to open that up wide, but I'm certain when Mr. Skinner left Washington, he knew that there'd be people wanting to talk to him from the media. So that I think he'll make himself available, certainly after he gets back, finishes up our brief meeting.